Okay, this evening's talk is a special talk because every time when I teach a meditation retreat, that I always spend one session talking about the jhanas, and I do this for several reasons. First of all, to explain it to the yogis here, because every now and again, one of the yogis presses the right button and they get into these amazing states of mind. And they need to know what those mean. Exactly why are there these things called jhanas? What their purpose is, how they come about. And also for those people who are visiting here, it's an essential important part of the Buddha's path. And it's also been a neglected part of the Buddha's path, which was actually quite surprising for me, because having been brought up in a forest tradition of northeast Thailand, where this was part of the tradition and was understood and accepted as being an essential part, it was important for me actually to also teach that type of meditation here in Western countries, Malaysia, Singapore, because it is crucial. If those of you who've seen my little book on the jhanas, you'll see that it opens up with a passage, a saying of the Buddha from the Dhammapada, which is that there is no wisdom without jhana, there's no jhana without wisdom. Then the one who has jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. Nati jhana apanyasa. There's no jhana for one without wisdom. Panya nati ajayato. There's no wisdom without jhana. Yamhi jhanang chapanya cha. For those who have jhana and wisdom, satve nibbana santike. They are in the presence of nibbana. So these are very important, and they are not that difficult. They can be done. So this evening, just as the last people come in, we're going to talk about the jhanas. Now there's one problem with the jhanas, and that is they're very pleasant. I say it's a problem because most people think that anything that pleasurable, anything that much fun, anything with that much ecstasy can't be good. We're a very strange bunch of human beings. We think that if it hurts, it must be good for us. However, sometimes pain can be a cause for understanding arising. But the point is, if one wants to follow the path to nibbana, if one wants to follow the path to the end of suffering, to the ultimate happiness, if you're going to follow the path of the ultimate happiness, surely it's going to be increasing happiness all the way. It's called Sukha Patipada, the happy practice. When I read in the suttas that the Buddha said there's four ways of practice, he says there's the path of suffering which is slow, the path of suffering which is fast, the path of happiness which is slow, and the path of happiness which is fast. I said, okay, I'll take the one which is happiness and fast. And you can take that one, and that's also the path which the Buddha took. Because for 6 years the Buddha to be, not yet a Buddha, still an unenlightened bodhisattva, as he called himself at that time, he was practicing all the austerities, and he got nowhere. And in the story of the Buddha, there's lots and lots of interesting tips about the way of practice in the Buddha's own life story. And you all know what happened. He gave up that austere ascetic practice. He took a nice meal. In fact, it was a meal fit for a deva. The woman, Sujata, had got this food to be left at a tree for a heavenly spirit. And the Buddha ate it. So it's not an ordinary meal, it was a delicious meal. He had a good bathe. He rested. And then he got a lovely bunch of grass, freshly cut, and made a nice cushion. So in other words, you have to look after your bottom if you want to get enlightened. Because too much pain is too much distraction. But before he did that, he wondered what he had to do, because he tried every possible method to become enlightened and nothing was working. And you all know what happened next. He recalled a time when he was a young boy, when his father was doing a little ceremony to start the ploughing season for the year. He, being a young boy, he wasn't participating in the ceremony. He sat under a rose apple tree. And actually, some of the committee members here, the organizers, they got a rose apple tree which they want to plant outside. It's supposed to be very fragrant. Now maybe that's actually one of the reasons why, when you sit under a rose apple tree, you can get these jhanas. Maybe just so fragrant, it sort of gives you that happiness, that peace, which you can turn into deep meditation. So, who knows, when that rose apple tree is planted, please sit underneath it. You never know your luck. And maybe that's actually where the simile of Sir Isaac Newton, because an apple fell on his head. Maybe that was a rose apple. And he became, but no, I don't think he got into jhanas. But the Buddha-to-be sat under a rose apple tree, and he spontaneously attained the state of first jhana. Now, where just before he became enlightened, when he was at that area, Uruwela, which is now called Bodh Gaya, he thought to himself, maybe that happiness of jhana, and I'm quoting directly from the suttas, if you want to check this out, Mahasachaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya, number 36. He said, that happiness and pleasure of that experience when I was a boy, perhaps that is the way to Bodhi, to enlightenment. And the insight arose in the Bodhisattva. That is the path to Bodhi. The jhana was the path to Bodhi, the Buddha realized. So the Buddha said, why was I afraid of that pleasure which has nothing to do with the world? Now that's also an important thing to remember, because people say, oh, you can be attached to that pleasure. You don't get attached to unworldly pleasures. It's the worldly pleasures you get attached to. I'm going to go off on a tangent here. When you do merit, you give a donation, you get pleasure. You don't get attached to those unworldly pleasures of giving charity. That's a happiness which is clean and pure. You can do as much charity as you like. When you keep your precepts pure, you get happiness. That is an unworldly happiness. You don't get attached to keeping your precepts. It is a pure freedom, a pure happiness. And it's the same when you do acts of compassion. You don't get attached to being compassionate. Otherwise, all the great Buddhas would have been called, you're just attached, you're helping somebody again. These are happiness which comes from compassion, which is free from any worldly taints. That's why those types of things are called unworldly happinesses. If you want to know the Pali, it's called Niramisa Sukha. So the Buddha said, why am I afraid of that type of happiness, of the jhanas? And it was because of that realization, he said, I will not be afraid. And from that time on, as I mentioned, I think earlier this morning, in many, many suttas, the Buddha said to his disciples, and you're his disciples, he said, please don't be afraid of that pleasure. Make much of it, follow it, and develop it. It leads to Bodhi. So as disciples of the Buddha, as people who have faith in what the Buddha said, we should never be afraid of those pleasures of jhana. We should actually follow it, make much of it, and develop it, as the Buddha said. The reason is that those pleasures, those jhanas, are states of freedom. You can't get attached to freedom. It's what's called an oxymoron. It's like, wise stupidity or black lightness. Two words which you put together which mean opposites of each other. You cannot be attached to letting go. Which is why that I coined the word some years ago to try and get away from people who think that you can be attached to the jhanas by saying that these are, in fact, stages of letting go. And I call the four jhanas the four stages of letting go. And I even called the Eightfold Path, Eighth Factor, Sammasamadhi, which too many people say is right concentration. I called it right letting go. And it is fair enough, that's a fair translation of that word. Right letting go. When I put it that way, it takes away all of the possibilities of thinking can be attached to these things. It takes away all of the possibilities that you can strive for Sammasamadhi. You say it's right concentration, and people think, well, concentration, I must do that. I must make concentration happen. But when you call it right letting go, the penny drops, you will have the understanding, develop that factor. It's not with striving, it's with stillness. These are states of letting go. These are states of very great stillness. Now think about it. If you're doing something, how can you be still? Activity is the opposite of stillness. Understanding that way, you get a feeling for what these states actually are. They're states of stillness, they're states of letting go, and you find that they're incredibly blissful. It seems strange in life, because ever since you were small, you had the idea that if you want to have happiness and success, you have to make it happen. You have to strive and work hard. And indeed, worldly success and worldly happiness, the opposite of Niramisa Sukha, called Amisa Sukha, worldly success, you do have to strive. You do have to work hard. To build my monastery, I had to work hard. If I want to build a monastery, I can't just sit there and let go. So there's times when you have to work hard. And this is what you've learned, what you've known. But that only works in worldly things. When we go to the Dhamma, this is another, as they say, ball game altogether. It follows different rules. This is where we let go, where stillness is paramount. And in that stillness, we get incredible happiness and bliss. Not the success of the world, but the happiness and bliss which is beyond the world. So these are incredibly strong states of mind. And because they are great strengths, because they're stages of letting go, because each one of them is actually almost defined, you understand it, not so much by what is there, but you understand it by what is missing. The things which have disappeared, by what has vanished. The more things which have vanished, the deeper those jhanas are. So you understand here, you're getting closer to the full vanishing of emptiness, of sunyata, to the full emptiness of non-self, anatta, to the full renouncing, relinquishing. This is a temporary letting go of all things, because afterwards those things come back again. But because you have gone to such a deep place of purity, of emptiness, you will never look at life in the same way again. You have an experience there, which literally changes your life. So, having given a little bit of information about those jhanas and how important they are, and how the Buddha was afraid of them, and he had to overcome that fear, and then he would actually sit under that Bodhi tree, develop those jhanas, and got all these amazing insights, and became a Buddha. And why he, from that time on, taught the path. The middle path is a way of, facilitating the experience of jhanas. Which is why it's the deliberate policy of mine to allow people to sit in chairs when you're meditating. I don't do this just because I'm soft and overly compassionate. I don't do this because I want more disciples. I need less disciples. I'm in trouble. I do this because I know that you have to be kind to your body. That is the middle path. Not being too austere, not being too slack. In most religions, people usually, they make the mistake of being too strict. Just like the Buddha's five disciples, who when the Buddha started on the path of jhanas, on the middle way, they abandoned him, saying, "You're being too slack. You're just indulging. My goodness, look at what you're eating, food for the devas. You're bathing. You're not just sitting on the roots, the bumpy, knobbly roots of the tree. You're getting a grass cushion. That's soft." Because austerity and asceticism was thought to be the path, his first five friends abandoned the Buddha completely. The Buddha had to have that inner strength to know, yeah, this is the path and I'm going to follow it. Other people couldn't see that. So after he became enlightened, it was the Buddha's first teaching. Please, 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 I found the path. It's not austerity and asceticism. That's called Attagilamatanu Yoga. It's one of the extremes of the middle way. He said, no, don't do that. Have a degree of comfort, but let go. And the Buddha taught that path of letting go, the Eightfold Path, which culminates in Samma Samadhi, right letting go, the four jhanas. All the time when the Buddha taught, in all the suttas, you can check it out by yourself, every time the Buddha explained what that eighth factor of the Eightfold Path meant, every time he said, Samadhi, Samma Samadhi, equals the four jhanas. He never explained it any other way. It's the factor of the path, the eighth factor. So exactly what happens? How do we develop these jhanas? And when I say how we develop them, it gives you some idea of what they are and how important they are. Now I'm going to mention their development using the framework of Anapanasati Sutta, but I mentioned to all you yogis, you can get it without Anapanasati. In brief, what those jhanas are, you let go of the world, in other words, your family, your money, your home. You don't concern yourself about worldly things. You let go of time, because time is part of craving. It is craving which creates time. If you look very deeply, when you don't crave, when you don't want anything, time disappears. Time has no meaning anymore. Time manifests when we measure with wanting something or wanting to get rid of things. Those who have little wanting are free of the burden, or rather the prison of time. So we let go of time. There's no time at all when you get into deep meditation. And then, most importantly, you let go of your body and your five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. When I say the body and the five senses, actually they're one and the same thing. The five senses are your body. Your body is the five senses. The body is there as a vehicle for the five senses to play in the world and to search for their pleasures. The five senses are the dominant thing. Sometimes people think it's the other way around, the five senses are there to protect the body, but no, the body is there for the five senses. If somebody was blind, deaf, they lost their sense of touch, smelling and taste, they would die. There'd be no purpose. The body is a vehicle for the five senses. Which is why that you meditators, many of you experience, when the five senses disappear, to all intents and purposes, so does your body. You can't feel the body, you can't hear any sounds, that world is gone. So the first part of the Anapanasati Sutta is trying to find a way of letting go of this body and its five senses. We see an in-breath as long, an in-breath as short, out-breath as long, out-breath as short, first in fact as short, first in fact as that's just to try and get hold of the breath. Then you experience a whole breath from the beginning to the end of each in-breath, the beginning to the end of each out-breath. That's the third state of Anapanasati. Then you calm that body of breath down. In other words, you allow it to get still. Your breath starts to become refined. Many of you got to that stage. And then what happens? Then you start to feel happiness and peace. You experience pity. You experience sukha. This happiness and joy in the mind. This is what I call the beautiful breath. I just change the words around to make it more appropriate to individuals' experience, because sometimes people say, these two words, pity and sukha, what do they mean? It doesn't really matter. It's just happiness and joy. You feel that inside. The beautiful breath, I mean, your breath is just so smooth, so nice, you're happy to be there, you're content. It becomes the effortless meditation. Why is it effortless? Do you need to really concentrate to watch the soccer? Do you really need to put forth effort to listen to look at your favorite movie? Is it a struggle to keep your attention when the movie is on? It's because it's joyful and happiness. You focused in on that movie. You become one-pointed and everything around you disappears. That happened to one of my students some years ago in Perth. Actually, two of them, husband and wife. They were watching a movie in the front room of their house in Perth. It must have been a very, very good movie because they were so immersed in the movie. They were one-pointed. They were concentrated. And after the movie finished, when they looked behind them, hey, the thing's missing. And they checked the rest of their house. A burglar had been in the house while they were watching the movie. And they were so cheeky, had come right into their room where they were watching and stolen things from behind the sofa where they were sitting. Now this is a thing, because once you get immersed in something like that, it's happiness and joy, you're completely oblivious to everything else. It becomes effortless one-pointedness. Now of course that's not a good thing to do at home when there's burglars around, but when you're meditating you've got nothing to lose. And so here, you can allow your mind to get one-pointed. When it gets happy, it's easy to watch the breath. Oh, it's so wonderful just watching the breath. That happiness and joy, that's called a vedana. It's a feeling. It's at this point, actually, you're not knowing the breath through the body touch so much as that the feeling is what's most important. It's a happy breath. The beauty becomes important. That is why that when you're watching the breath as the ordinary feeling, the Buddha said that's the first satipatthana. You know, contemplating body. He said that's enough, because that disappears and you can see it vanishing from the experience of deep meditation. You see the vedana, piti sukha. This becomes a second satipatthana. And when you calm that vedana down, which is the next step in Anapanasati Sutta, the happiness and bliss becomes so subtle, so wonderful. It's the happiness of the breath. You're seeing the breath as a feeling rather than a thing. So in the seventh stage, you experience the whole thing. The whole breath becomes beautiful. And lastly, number eight, you calm that breath, that feeling down. By calming it down, you don't do the calming, it happens naturally. And it goes off into the ninth stage of the 16 steps of Anapanasati, which is to experience a jitta. The mind. Now many of you would love to know what the mind is. We all think that we have a mind, but we don't know what it is. And many philosophers, they start to talk about whether it is a mind or not a mind. Scientists go crazy thinking that the mind is some byproduct of the brain. And I've told you before about boys which will have no brain. I've told you before about people who have consciousness after their brain is dead and near-death experiences. Or that disciple of mine who got into a jhana and was brain dead. Uh-oh, looks like there's something coming out here. Is this a car in trouble? No, dear, I know it's not my car. Okay, so back to the jhanas. So when you get to that stage, you get the mind appearing. Now, at this point, the meditation gets really interesting, because this is the stage, all of you yogis here, it's the stage of the nimitta coming up. Now, what a nimitta is the mind manifesting. When the five senses of seeing, smelling, tasting and touching disappear, you're left with the sixth sense, the mind. It's a strange thing. Because I was born in UK, because I grew up with Christianity and philosophy, I was really strange that there's only five senses in the West. Because when you talk about the five senses, you just think of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. What happened to the mind? In fact, there was a movie some years ago called The Sixth Sense. And I thought, it's the mind. It was something to do with ghosts and stuff like that. I said, that's crazy. Buddhists have had a sixth sense for a long time. And when I actually studied philosophy and history, I found a strange thing I found was that all of the ancient Greek philosophers, which are supposed to be where the Western science and Western religion got its basis from, all of those philosophers started off with six senses. Whether it was Socrates, Plato, they all talked about six senses. They were smart enough to know there's not just the five, there's the mind as well. In fact, Aristotle called it, the mind, the common sense, because it's common to all the other five senses. So I joked that in the West, somewhere along the last 2,000 years, not only have we lost our mind, but we've also lost our common sense. But Buddhism, we've kept our mind, we've kept our common sense. And that actually tells quite a lot. But when we go to our mind, what is that mind? When you get the five senses disappearing, what you've got left is the mind. Now look, if you want to do an experiment, if you want to find out the qualities of something, for example, if you want to find out the properties of gold, what do you have to do? You have to purify the gold, first of all, to make sure it's got no impurities, no other elements like tin or iron. So it's pure, pure gold. And once you've got pure gold as a chemist, then you can find out its properties. If you've got a small amount of imperfections, you will never really truly understand what it is. It's the same with the mind. If you want to find out what the mind is, you've got to purify it. Get pure mind with no other senses in the way. That's why that stage of meditation, when you've got a nimitta coming up, the nimitta is a reflection of your mind. You actually got the mind right in front of you. Then you actually understand what this mind is. That's the first time you come face to face with a mind. Your mind. Now, that's the ninth stage of Anapanasati. The 10th and 11th stage of Anapanasati, you've got to stabilize the mind. Because that citta, when it first comes up, that nimitta, sometimes it's moving all over the place. It flashes up. It's not stable. You can't keep it there. So you have to find out how to stabilize it. Calm it down. It's all how to let go. And you also have to brighten it up. It's called Abhipamojiyang Jitang. To brighten it up so it's very brilliant and very bright. Usually when these things come up, they're already brilliant. They're already stable. If you've done lots of letting go. And that's when these beautiful lights come into the mind and they stay there. And the most amazing, beautiful things you've ever seen. We call them nimittas because they're a reflection. They're a sign of the mind. They use the same word when you look in a mirror. That which you see there, your reflection, your image, is called your nimitta of your face. That's all the nimitta means. It's a reflection. It's an image. Now, the important thing is you do not see that with your physical eye, because the eye is gone. It's subsided. You're not seeing anything at all. If you've got some gizmo measuring the activity of your optic nerve, it will be registered nil. Nothing's happening there. This is a mental object. But it's seen. It's perceived rather as a sight, because that's the closest thing. When you get into this realm of the mind, it's fascinating, because this is where you get to understand where perception is. Why we perceive things in certain ways is because we have an experience, and our mind searches through its data bank of similar experiences. It gets the one which is most similar, and that's the language we use to describe it. To do with memory, the data bank of experience. All perception, all understanding is comparison. It's like this. It's close to that. That's how we make sense of it. When we first have these nimittas, yeah, it's like a brilliant light. The most important part of that nimitta is its brightness and its stability, its energy, its power. And this is where fear can come up very easily. Because when those lights come up, a lot of time they're incredibly bright and powerful. Wow, they knock you away. This is where you always remember what the Buddha said. He said, why am I afraid of that beauty of the mind, that power, that happiness? He said, I will not be afraid. So any of you yogis, any of you meditators who get a nice nimitta and it's powerful, you get afraid. Always remember, the Buddha was afraid as well. You're in very, very good company. And all you need to do is to have faith. Have some confidence. If you don't have confidence in me, go and look in the sutras and you find, yeah, this is going to happen. It's expected to happen. It's par for the course. Just let go of the fear, just as the Buddha and the great monks and nuns have done. And you will have a wonderful time. Now, another interesting thing about these nimittas, when they come up, sometimes they are not brilliant. Sometimes they're very dirty and murky. What's going on there? I already said you're seeing a reflection of your mind. It means your mind is dirty and murky. That's what happens. It means you have not been keeping your precepts. It means you haven't been compassionate. It means you haven't been generous. You have been selfish. It's great when you come across nimittas, but you cannot deceive yourself here. It's actually you're seeing what you've been doing. If you've been angry at your husband before coming on this retreat, when you get a nimitta, it's not going to be nice. So this is actually why, when I started playing around with these nimittas and finding out what they were, I realized how important virtue is for meditation. This is actually where I saw the link. I heard the Buddha say that before, that you've got to practice virtue before you can really do meditation. Without fulfilling the virtue, you can't succeed in meditation, he said. I thought, what's that got to do with it? And actually I know why now, because to get those nimittas, if it's going to be a brilliant one, you have to have a pretty good standard of virtue, of generosity and compassion. And if you have those, you've all done pretty well. If you really enhance your virtue, your generosity, your compassion, your nimitta will be brilliant when it arises. It will blow you away of just how pure and wonderful it is. In fact, for those who know these Pali terms, the Buddha said, that nimitta, that mind, which is free of the hindrances, is called Pabbasura. I say that because among monks these days, we have a lot of discussion about something called the Pabbasura Citta, the radiant mind. And of course, when you actually know these things deeply, you understand exactly what it's talking about. The mind without the five hindrances is called by the Buddha the Pabbasura Citta, the radiant mind. When you get that nimitta, it's so strong, it is radiant, it's incredibly powerful and bright. Brighter than the sun. You're not seeing it with your eyes, so you never get blinded, you just get scared at first. You get scared, how can I handle so much power? You can. Sometimes it's so blissful, you wonder, how can you handle so much bliss? You can. One of the insights which I've got from my experience you can always take more ecstasy. You can always handle more bliss. There's no limit to it. You can bliss out to the max. And I really mean happiness. This is what I've said many times. I've used this as a title of my presentation at the, was it, third global conference in Singapore last June, for those of you who were there. Just to make a point, I said, a bliss better than sex. And I meant it. And that gets people really interested. Yeah, I want this. Come on. This is what happens. This is why the Buddha was afraid. It was just so powerful and blissful. But it's supposed to be like this. When you start to end suffering, when you start to get close to Nirvana, the ultimate happiness, what do you expect it to be? Do you expect on the gateway to enlightenment it's going to be suffering and pain? When you're so close to Nirvana, it's going to be so much happiness and bliss. And it's going to be power as well. The Buddha said the mind is the forerunner of all things. It's the most powerful. Now you're understanding that. This is your bare experience of how powerful your mind can be. So what happens is you get this nimitta to come up, you brighten it up, make it really beautiful, make it very still. How do you make it still? There's an old simile which Ajahn Chah taught. In fact, it's such a famous simile, it's the title of one of his books. But the simile as written in that book is not the full simile. It's called A Still Forest Pool. The full simile goes like this. And this is a powerful metaphor for what you should do to meditate and gain success. This metaphor was especially employed for the time of nimittas, when these beautiful lights come up in the mind. But you can use this for any experience in your meditation. It tells you what we mean by letting go and how to do that letting go. So many of you, again, are very hard to understand what this letting go really means and how actually you actualize the letting go. You know, you can't do letting go, you have to let go of the letting go to achieve the letting go. It comes so difficult, but this is a great way of understanding what it means. The still forest pool. That simile is relevant to the time when there were still jungles and forests in Thailand. And when it became part of the monk's life to go wandering. Usually you'd stay as a monk in your monastery for 5 years. And after 5 years you had your basic training, you knew your rules, you could do your chanting, you could actually live independent of your teacher. You had enough meditation success that you could be stable and go meditate under the trees without too much problem. And it was a wonderful experience. I remember when I did my year of wandering the forests and the jungles of Thailand. Imagine what it was like. You just had your bowl and your robes. You had to carry everything with you. In our monastery, we took it seriously. You could not leave any belongings back in your monastery. You took them with you or you gave them up. There was no storage. First of all, you tried to get your belongings to a bare minimum. But even that, when you were walking all day, you soon learned how to get rid of even more stuff. And after a week or so, you were traveling so lightly. You knew that where you got to in the morning, any village in Thailand, you could go on arms round. At least you'd get some rice, maybe a banana. It was enough to keep you going. So you didn't need to worry about food. You could sleep out under the trees, either in the paddy fields or in the jungles. You didn't need a home. You didn't need money. All you needed was a change of robes, that's all. And your bowl. That was one of the most wonderful times in my life. Everything you owned, you carried. And it was so light. When you came to a crossroads, you could go left, right, ahead, or just turn around. You had complete freedom, with no ties, no family, no possessions, no loans, no mortgages, nothing. Imagine that type of freedom. And you were so secure, you knew you'd always have a meal the next day. You'd always have a place to sleep under the trees. You had no belongings, no ties. You literally were like a wild animal, like a bird. It was a beautiful life. It was just a shame afterwards that when the forest got cut down, when there's so many roads, wherever you walked, it became always trucks going fast, and you lost that sense of solitude and freedom. But that's what it used to be like in the time of the Buddha. I'm very fortunate as a monk that I've tasted that and know what it meant. But always when it came to the evening time, or really the mid-afternoon, you would always look for a river, a small pond, some sort of body of water, even a well, because walking all day, your little flask of water would be empty. You need to refill it. You'd want to wash because it's always dusty and dirty, even in the jungles. Actually, in the jungles, it was wonderful. There's always some flower was in flower. It was always fragrant. Every time of the year, the forest was fragrant. These are the real rainforest jungles. It was a beautiful thing to experience. But in the evening, you look for a body of water, and you'd fill up your flask, you'd bathe to take the dust of the day off your body, and you probably wash a couple of robes as well. And having filled up your flask, you sit under your mosquito net, usually about 10 or 20 meters away from the edge of the water, because in the evening the animals would come out to do exactly the same which you were doing. They'd drink and they'd wash their body, though they wouldn't wash their clothes, they didn't have any robes. But apart from that, they were the same. So Ajahn Chah, who lived that lifestyle for many, many years, told the story that sometimes he would actually sit under his mosquito net after having bathed, filled his water flask, and instead of closing his eyes and meditating, would keep them open, just to watch the jungle animals when they came out of the evening. It was just like those nature films which you see. These were wild animals, not pets. They'd come out in the evening to drink, but if they sensed there was somebody there watching, especially a human being, they would think it was a hunter. It would be so dangerous for them that if they sensed there was a human being, they'd run away. So he said the only way he could watch those animals was to be absolutely still, not to move. If he moved, they'd sense him. And they would turn around and go back in the forest. Even if they were thirsty, they wouldn't risk their lives if they knew a human being was around. He said it was not that hard to keep still because he was a meditator. Because he was still, these animals would come out, they would drink, they would play, and it was just so delightful to see animals in the wild play around. They're just like human beings, they're naughty, they're mischievous. I remember once seeing this group of birds come out to drink. And they all, it's amazing that this was while they all stood in line, just like a queue at a bank or something. First come in the front, next come in the next, all in the queue. And then the first one would bathe, they'd drink, flap its wings as the birds do. And then there was one really naughty bird jumped the queue. And all the other birds descended on it and basically beat it up and pecked it off. Just like human beings. And that's why when you see nature in the wild, it's just so much fun. It's delightful. It's better than watching the TV. So Ajahn Chah would do that in the evening, just watch his animals play and become mischievous. But he had to be absolutely quiet to watch them. But he said sometimes, once the ordinary animals had played by the still forest pool, if he was really quiet, some other animals would come out from the jungle. And these were incredibly beautiful animals. Animals he'd never seen before. Beings who even his teachers and his parents never told him existed. They were the most strange and weird and rare animals you could ever imagine. But so beautiful. They were so rare because they were incredibly shy and very sensitive. If they knew there was somebody was watching, they could sense them so easily. And they'd run back into the forest and never come out again for months. Sometimes he was so still that even these rare and very beautiful animals would not know he was there. And they'd come out and drink by the still forest pool. And he would enjoy their company. They wouldn't know he was there. He said that simile was for the beautiful nimittas. These nimittas, these lights which come up in the mind stands for the still forest pool. Ajahn Chah watching stands for your mindfulness. The animals, so rare, are either the nimittas or the jhanas which come next. Once this nimitta comes out, if it knows you're watching, if you move, that nimitta will go right back in the jungle, will not come out again for days. You've blown it. What happens is people get excited. Wow, look at that! The animal, in this case the nimitta, has heard you, will run away. All of you who've seen a flashing light, and it's disappeared immediately, that is what has happened. It's come out to play by your still mind, and it's known you were watching, and it's gone away. Or sometimes you get afraid. You've never seen anything like that before. It's incredible, it's weird, very powerful. You're afraid. Because of fear, the animal knows you're there, can smell your fear, and will run back into the jungle and never come out again. So understanding that simile, which is so perfect, it's a beautiful simile, you understand what you have to do at this stage in the meditation. You have to be like an Ajahn Chah by the still forest pool. You have to be like one of these wildlife photographers. You have to be like a paparazzi taking a picture of Princess Diana. If you move, her bodyguards, well, she's dead now, but you know what I mean, Madonna or something. Actually, one of my friends, one of the disciples in Perth, he was a paparazzi. And he heard that, what's her name? The Kylie Minogue, that she had some nervous breakdown. He heard she'd gone to Broome in the north of Western Australia. And he told me it's the most exciting time of his life as a photographer. Because he crawled through the bushes outside this resort, Cable Beach Resort in Broome. And he saw her. And he got her. And he went all around the world. His photographs earned a fortune. Really mean and nasty, I told him. But he was so excited. But I said, now, if you can only do that with your meditation, you'll be a great meditator. To be able to sneak up on the nimitta without the nimitta knowing you're going to take a photograph. Now, that's the sort of mind you have. It's got to be so still, so subtle, so peaceful. And then that nimitta will stay. Why does it move? Another simile, this is my simile. I use the idea like a nimitta is like a reflection of your face. In this case, a reflection of your mind. Imagine you're watching a reflection of yourself in a mirror. Right when you're brushing your teeth in the morning. And that reflection is moving backwards and forwards. And you think, the mirror is moving. So you're trying to hold the mirror to make it still. That will not make the image become still. It's not the mirror's fault. It's the one who is watching's fault. When you're at that stage in the meditation, the one who is watching has to be very, very still. You, the watcher, the knower, has to be motionless. Then what you see, which is a reflection of that, Noah, the jitta, the mind, that is then still. That's how you keep the stillness. You get to this 11th stage of Anapanasati. The Buddha said that this is called Chittanusati. the reflection of the mind. It fulfills the third satipatthana. What happens next is amazing. That nimitta is just so still. You know you're watching a nimitta. You know that you're watching this beautiful light. It gets brighter and brighter, more and more brilliant. Now one of two things happen. It's exactly the same thing viewed from different perspectives. You fall into that nimitta. Or that nimitta envelops you. You get the most incredible bliss. If you have enough stillness, you'll stop with that bliss. Sometimes for many hours. Unchanging, incredible bliss. When you ask yourself afterwards, what was I aware of? What was the object of my mindfulness? You'll only be able to say one thing. Bliss. There's no breath left anymore. Not in front of your perception. You're not conscious of breathing. You're not conscious of your body. You're not even conscious of the nimitta anymore. That has done its job. All you're aware of is bliss. In the suttas, that's called vivekaja piti sukha. The bliss, the piti sukha, which is born of the five senses being put down, the body disappearing. When it says the aloofness or the separation, the seclusion, the renunciation, always understand why, what's being renounced, what you've let go of. You've let go fully now of the body and the five senses. At that stage you can't hear any sounds, you can't feel the body. If someone kicked you, you would not feel it. If the person sitting next to you snored, you would not hear it. All of these things are gone. I'll tell you tomorrow the insight which comes from that experience when you contemplate it afterwards. Basically you find why that's so blissful. Why that's the most happiness, the most ecstasy you've ever felt so far. It exceeds the bliss of the nimittas many, many fold. Those are two of the factors, the happiness and joy. They're combined together because it's all one mass of bliss, ekagata. The vitaka vichara, because somebody asked this yesterday. Those two factors are just what I call the wobble in that first jhana. The mind is with that bliss. Actually, what's happening there? There is still a residue of grasping, of attachment. You're not that confident to fully let go to the max. You hold that bliss. Because you hold it, it's not sustainable. You recede away from the bliss. The bliss starts to break up. And you feel that the attention, the knower, if you like, moves slightly away from the bliss. Instead of being completely absorbed in it, there's some distance between you, the knower, and the bliss. But because it's so powerful, you get drawn right back in there again. Being drawn right back in is called the vitaka. The holding of it is the vichara. It's just a wobble, that's all. It's so close to being one-pointed. It counts as one-pointedness of mind. It's one of the great senses of samadhi, unification of mind. In that state, it's incredibly blissful. Because of its stability, you stay in there for a long period of time. If you only stay in there for 1 second, it's not really a jhana. I call it ping-pong jhana. You just go in, you come out again. You might as well call it that if you want, just to encourage you, but it's not really the real thing. If you really get in there, you're in there for a long time. The reason is because it's so stable. Look, if you can watch a movie on the television for a couple of hours because you're having a good time, you can't take your eyes, as it were. This is just a metaphor, there's no seeing. You can't take your eyes off that bliss. You're having such a wonderful time, nothing else matters. My goodness, you can't come out. You don't want to, you're having a great time. So people who get in those jhanas, it's usually 2-3 hours or something, and they're sitting there having the most wonderful time of their life. And they don't care about breakfast anymore, about lunch. Who cares about that? They don't even care about a talk by Ajahn Brahm. They're just sitting there completely oblivious, having the time of their lives. And good on them. There's a lot of benefit from this afterwards. So in this talk this evening, I'm not focusing on the insight and what this means to your understanding. I'm just focusing on the experience. But just because I'm focusing on the experience, please don't think this is without insight. These huge insights come from these stages. That's why the Buddha became enlightened. He got huge insights from these jhanas. Quite naturally, what happens next? In those states, you can't proceed any further. You can't, but the state can develop by itself. Another thing which is almost gone in this jhana, but which becomes very clear that you've let go of in the next jhana, which is very strange, is your will. Your potential to do. The real controller in that first jhana, because there's a touch of grasping onto that bliss, which is the vichara, and there's a moving towards it. Technically speaking, if you're going to be very refined, you are still doing something. Subconsciously, subverbally, there's still a movement there. But when you let go of that movement, just because of confidence, you're confident enough to fully let go with that bliss, so you don't hold on to it anymore. And it stays absolutely immobile. The last bit of doing, of will, of choice, of intention, of aspiration, that which moves you, has now completely gone. You're in such a solid and stable, diamond, rock-like state where no movement is possible. You are like frozen, frozen in bliss. That particular bliss is called Samadhija Pittisukha, the bliss which comes of absolute stillness. You've let go of something which was so common, always there for you, but it's so strange, it's like nothing you've experienced before. Not just the bliss, but the fact is it's got the taste of one of the most important parts of what you took to be yourself having completely vanished. The potential to do, to be in control, has gone. That is weird. It's a completely different level of consciousness where the doer is no longer there. Vanished completely. The first time it's gone. Now you understand what that doer really is. This is the deep state of second jhana. If you are lucky, every one of these jhanas lies within the one before. I used that simile yesterday of the thousand petal lotus. The reason I use that simile is because it gives a great metaphor, a way to understanding what these jhanas are in. When the Buddha said, there's Buddha nature inside of you, this is what it is. Every state is right within the one you're in now. Those jhanas are right within your consciousness in this very moment. You've just got to get in there to feel them, to know them. They're right in this body. You go into time. Timelessness is in the middle of time. Silence is in the middle of thoughts. The breath is in the middle of your body. The beautiful breath is in the middle of the breath. The nimitta is in the middle of that happiness, which is called the beautiful breath. The jhanas come right in the middle of the nimittas, which is why you either sink right into the middle of the nimitta, or the nimitta goes around you. It's in the middle. In the middle of the first jhana, and right in the center of it is the second jhana. So you don't throw something off and go somewhere else. You just go deeper into where you are now. Deeper into the center. In the middle of that second jhana, you come across the third jhana, where it's another type of happiness altogether, far more refined, which is the pity part, which is the disturbing part of happiness. You get a bliss which is more blissful than the bliss you've had before, which you thought was the maximum you could ever experience. Now, if you really want to find out what ecstasy is, what bliss is, what happiness is, you're now becoming the expert on ecstasy. Sometimes people think they know about happiness. In the world, only great monks, meditators, know what happiness is. You think that, you know, falling in love is the greatest thing ever happened to you. Sex, great sex, even drugs. That is nothing. That's not a millionth part of the happiness which you get in these deep meditations. If you really want to know what happiness and pleasure is, you get in these meditations and it'll blow your mind. So you get into these amazing happinesses. And then another level of happiness comes next with the equanimity, the absolute stillness. And sometimes it's like the happiness has disappeared, but that is an even better happiness. It is the happiness of no happiness. That might sound like a Zen koan to you, but you get that experience, you know exactly what it means. That might sound like a Zen koan to you, but you get that experience, you know exactly what it means. The happiness has disappeared, and that is even more happy. And you go on through these jhanas as the mind gets more and more refined, more and more close to sunyata, to emptiness. It's going, 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 gone. As I said last night, with full cessation happens shortly afterwards. These are the jhanas. This is what happens. When you're in those states, you can't come out. The deeper you are in those jhanas, the longer they last. In those very, very deep jhanas, you last a long time. You can't come out. You're sitting there. It's not you don't want to come out. It's the ability to come out. The ability to make a decision is completely gone. And because there's no craving, there's no decision making possible, it is timeless. In those states that some people sit for days and they haven't got a clue that days have gone past. It doesn't have any meaning at all. Just like 5 seconds, 5 days, absolutely still. People used to do this. I've told too many times the story of my disciple who went to hospital and was had his... You all know that one, don't you? Put your hand up if you haven't heard about the disciple of mine who went to hospital because he was in jhana. Okay. Come on, you know that, don't you? Haven't heard it. Okay, here we go. One of my disciples, maybe about 40-year-old Australian man, sitting at home one day, he'd only used to do about 40 minutes of meditation a day. That was his limit. He decided, I think it was Saturday afternoon or something, he told his wife he's going into his bedroom to meditate. An hour and a half later, he still hadn't come out, so his wife checked him, went to check, see what he was doing. Because an hour and a half was strange for him, it was only about 40 minutes he'd come out. When his wife went into the bedroom, she saw him still in meditation, being absolutely motionless. In fact, too still. She could not see his abdomen rising and falling at all. So she checked and couldn't see any sign of breath. So she rang the ambulance, 000 in Perth, emergency. Within 5 minutes, an ambulance screamed to a halt in front of their house. And the medics rushed out into the bedroom, took his pulse. When they could find no pulse, they put him straight into the stretcher and raced him to Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital in Perth. In the ambulance, they could find no breathing, no sign of pulse. And that ambulance went through as many red traffic lights as it could. The sirens were wailing. This was an emergency. They rushed him into the ER room, and of course, the first thing they do in the ER room is put on the ECG to measure your heart rate. The monitor registered a flat line. Ding, 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 cardiac arrest, emergency. The machine wasn't lying. His heart was not moving at all. The next thing they did was the EEG to measure his brain activity. The monitor registered another flat line. Ding, 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 emergency, he was brain dead. It was my disciple who was brain dead and cardiac arrest. It's wonderful. And it was a very lucky thing that the doctor on duty was of Indian descent, otherwise he'd have just taken this guy down to the morgue. And when this guy had come out of his meditation, which he did later on, he probably really would have caused 2 deaths from the morgue workers who saw this corpse suddenly come out of meditation. He wasn't dead. Now, for those of you who read the suttas, you'll find that when somebody asks, what's the difference between a dead person and somebody in deep meditation? The answer was that the body is still warm. And actually, this is what the doctor said. He said the bottom half from the waist down was as cold as you'd expect a corpse. The top half was still warm. Even though there was no heartbeat, there was no brain activity. So the doctor decided to give this guy a chance. He'd had, obviously his wife had said he got into this condition while he was meditating. He'd heard from his parents that yogis can suspend their life activities through meditation. He may have done this, so he decided to try and get the heart going again. How do you get the heart going again in hospital? Electric shocks. So he put these pads on his chest, zap, zap, many, many times. Now I mention this because in those deep jhanas, you could have electric shocks put on your chest and you wouldn't know a thing about it. He never knew a thing about it, he told me afterwards. Many, many times, electric shocks, still, flat line, ding, 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 cardiac arrest, emergency, brain dead, ding, 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 ding. You're only supposed to actually to be brain dead for sort of, I don't know how many minutes. Well, actually, not that. So if you're cardiac arrest for about 1, 3 or 4 minutes, you have brain death or brain damage. He was many, 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 many minutes. I didn't actually say how much. I should actually ask him how long it was so I can actually tell the story completely. But it was a long time until he decided to come out of his meditation. And the meditation finished. And he opened his eyes and he was lying on his back, so he bent up. Where the heck am I? I was in my room, in bed. What's happened? As soon as he opened his eyes and came out of his meditation, the alarm stopped ringing. The brain activity was normal. The heart activity was absolutely normal. The doctor just checked him out. Nothing wrong with you. Go home. So he walked home. And I asked him about those experiences because it's a great little story. Number one, what did you do? When I ask these questions, I know the answers, but I have to ask them so that I can tell these answers in my talks. He said, I really let go. He said, I really let go for the first time. Standard answer to that question. If any of you get into deep meditation, I ask you, what did you do? I really let go, you'll tell me. You actually understand what that word truly means. Number two question is, what were you experiencing all that time? Could you hear the sirens of the ambulance? No. Could you feel those medics lift you up and put you in that trolley? No. Could you feel electric shocks? No. Were you unconscious? No. Were you mindful? Yes. Super mindful. But what was the content of your mindfulness? The most amazing bliss I've ever felt. That's what he felt. He was fully mindful of bliss. He was in a jhana, a deep one. That's what happens. Even my teacher, Ajahn Chah, the last 9 or 10 years of his life, he was in a coma. Sort of. Because we knew exactly what he was up to. So every now and again he'd get into jhana. We knew this because on one occasion, he stopped breathing. Yes, he used to stop breathing on many occasions. But on this particular occasion, one of my best friends, Ajahn Yana, now at Watnana Chat, he was on duty there. Because what happened? As soon as Ajahn Chah had this problem, I think this excess fluid on the brain or something, had a stroke, all the monks met together, our teacher, you know, he's incapacitated, what should we do? And they all made the decision, all the monks together, took a unanimous vote, we don't want sort of medical intervention, let's just let it take its natural course. If he dies, he's given so many good teachings, we've got all the Dhamma, he's done his job, let's let him go off into Parinibbana, leave him alone, let him disappear. Now we've got so much out of him already, out of compassion for our teacher, let's let him go. So they decided not to have any medical intervention, just let him die. However, the king of Thailand heard that, and he sent a letter straight away. No, you will not. You will keep that monk alive. And now, unfortunately, when the King of Thailand says those things, even though that the monks are supposed to be higher than the King of Thailand, they thought, uh-oh, we better keep our teacher alive. So they kept him alive for many years. And the King of Thailand paid for the nurse, a male nurse on roster, 24 hours a day, at his bedside for about 9 or 10 years. And it was the monks, we all volunteered to do little services, to be sort of the attendants. And this was just one night amongst many. Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And the nurse wanted to get him breathing again. The monk said, look, leave him alone. He's just meditating. The nurse didn't believe that. Because the nurse was trained in medicine. If you stop breathing, you'll soon become brain dead. And that will be the end of Ajahn Chah. The nurse knew that Ajahn Chah would one day die, but he did not want Ajahn Chah to die on his shift. So he wanted to get Ajahn Chah going. The monks argued with him, leave him alone. No, I've got to do something. Leave him alone. No, I've got to do something. They came to a compromise. The nurse took blood samples every few minutes. Because the compromise was, look, as long as there's oxygen in the blood, it doesn't matter whether the heart's beating or not, or whether you're breathing or not. As long as there's oxygen in the blood, there will never be brain damage. So that's what they did. And they found out an amazing thing, that when you're in jhanas, you're not breathing, the heart's not pumping, but you maintain blood pressure, and there's always oxygen in the blood. The oxygen level never lessened for many hours. Fascinating piece of medical advice, medical research. So when you're actually in this jhana, you don't need to breathe. You're so still, you don't use oxygen. That's why the brain doesn't die. The oxygen is there for it, if it needs it. But it's so still, it doesn't use anything at all. Why does it need to breathe? That's the stillness of the jhanas. The Buddha said, this is the way to Bodhi. Why? What's the way to enlightenment? Number one, first of all, as many people say, and it's very true, within those jhanas you cannot get any insight at all. Within the jhanas you don't get any insight. Because the mind can't move. To understand means you have to move. But the point is, you have so much data which you collect. You can't figure it all out at the time. But when you emerge from those jhanas, your mind is so powerful. And you have those experiences. It's those experiences after the jhana, when the mind moves and reflects upon them, that's where enlightenment usually happens. You have the amazing experience. You have the data. Like in a scientific experiment, you've got some really rare, very powerful, undeniable experiences. And after the jhana, your mind moves on it. And it starts to see things you never expected. You understand what anatta truly is. What dukkha is. What impermanence is. And I'll talk about those tomorrow. Without really having to, you don't make a decision, as the Buddha said, in the Anguttara Nikaya. You had such a powerful experience. Not only will you ask me, what the heck was that? You come to the interviews and say, Ajahn Brahm, help, I've just had this experience, what is it? You'd also be thinking about it yourself. You contemplate it. And from those natural and avoidable contemplations, you'll find out what's going on. Other little side effects, if you've got such a powerful mind, you get into those bliss states, you are not going to have many illnesses. Your mind is just too powerful. Amazing, just sort of illnesses which disappear with such deep meditation. You may even get some psychic powers. If you want to know what psychic powers are, the power of the mind from those states is huge. You understand where those psychic powers come from. Your mental energy is amazing. That's why sometimes people get scared. They don't know if they can handle that sort of energy. But always know this. I said, and from the early stages, if you haven't got virtue, your nimitta is not strong enough to actually get that degree of power. So there is a fail-safe mechanism there. if you want to try and use those powers for improper purposes, if you are immoral, then your nimitta just gets all dirty. You can't gain that power anymore. It all fades away. That's what happened to Devadatta. He got those powers, but because of his lack of virtue, his pride, his selfishness, it all faded away. So those powers are only for those who have virtue. It's one of those natural laws which is actually very helpful. You can't have the powers and be cruel and mean and selfish at the same time. That's wonderful. So they're safe. Those are the jhanas. Tomorrow I'll tell you how they're used for insight. But for the time being, I will leave it there. Now, are there any questions? I'm sorry there were no jokes or very few jokes, because it's very hard to have a joke about jhana. It's just, you know, too out of this world. But I would too say sometimes that I give a a recruiting campaign. Years ago, I did a recruiting campaign for my monastery, because, you know, we were looking for more monks. These days we don't do any recruiting because we're too full. But I said, was saying just about the pleasures you get from being a monk. They say you don't get much money. Your salary is not all that good being a monk. But I said the retirement plan is out of this world. Literally. Okay, questions, yeah. You got a question, yeah? Thank you very much. You're so kind. Now go on. Okay, you're saying if your sila is not pure, no matter how hard you meditate, you can't get into jhanas. That's not quite true. It just makes it much, much harder. The more purified your sila is, the easier it is to get into jhanas. But there is a way. The way is, and I tell this to the people here, you have to have pretty good sila. But if it's not absolutely perfect, when your nimitta comes up, the affection of the mind, it'll be a bit dirty. Or it'll be dull. It won't be just brilliant and pure. But, and this is the technique which I teach you, which is important, because, you know, you can actually get these jhanas without being such a pure, you know, really, really, really pure person. In that nimitta, somewhere will be the most beautiful spot. You know, in that, whether it's a disc or a screen, you look for the spot which is the brightest, which is the most pure and beautiful. There'll always be a wonderful place in there, which is like that. And that's where you focus, the most pure part. Leave aside the dirty parts or the rubbishy parts, get the best part. As you focus, you actually go into that, that sort of expands and that becomes your real nimitta. And in the center of that is the most beautiful part. And it's one way of which I call like shining and beautifying your nimitta. Take the best of the best of the best. And if you know how to do that, you've got a dull nimitta, you can get the center of it, which is beautiful. And you get the center of that, and get the center of that. That's how you do it. Yeah, you got another question? So, my goodness. Yeah? When it's a question from the back, I can't hear it completely. Can someone relay that to me? Yeah. Okay, something to do with silver microphone. I can't fully hear it from the back. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. I've never done silver mind control because I did sort of Buddha mind control, as it were. But it's not really mind control, it's always mind letting go. So I'm not quite sure what state is similar to what. But I really can't answer that because it's beyond my knowledge. Oh, yeah. Okay, am I getting the question that you're saying that as you meditate to that state, there's many other uses for it? Okay, you're asking or commenting about the benefits of such meditation, saying, if I can remember correctly, from the silver mind control, you get many other benefits, many goodness, which comes from that. And that's very, very true, which is why at all stages of the meditation, even just the not such refined stages of the meditation, you find you're kinder, more peaceful, more happy, more generous, even more successful people. So, you know, the meditation which you learn is wonderful at all things which you do in life. But I think maybe, I'm not quite sure, but do you have to pay for silver mind control? So the only difference is here, it's for free. Because no one makes money out of it. But it's even deeper. The Buddha was there a long time before the fellow who invented silver mind control. And this is a well-worn path. People have been doing this for 2,500 years. We know all of the problems, all the difficulties, and also all of the benefits. I've only mentioned a few of the benefits for you, I mention the real benefits tomorrow. Enlightenment benefits. Wisdom, insight benefits. But quite naturally, look, the first time I got into a deep meditation, I just wanted to get to my teacher's feet and just kiss them all over, literally. Because if you may remember, those of you who had any deep experiences know what it's like, incredible gratitude and compassion for those people who have given you such a gift. And if you want to do loving kindness meditation, which we're doing in the morning, if you do it after a jhana, you zap them. And my goodness, they feel it. You've got power. So if you want to really heal somebody, do healing. You know, it's amazing what you can do with these deep meditations. But of course, the main thing you do is teach people wisdom. Teach people to let go of suffering. And you don't need anything in the world. You've got so much happiness. You could actually give so much more. You've got the energy to give. And how on earth can you get angry and upset and jealous and fearful? No way that those things can come up. So there's many, many benefits. You do become a really good person. You really become a kind person. The more selfless you are, the kinder you become. Yes? Questions? I hope I answered that question. If I didn't, please come up to the microphone afterwards.
Madam Ram. I have two questions here from a yogi. First one, you were saying Buddhism is about happiness and compassion. I agree very much with you, but why are there monks who are very stern and have serious looks? Don't you think this will frighten the lay devotees in this compassion? Thank you.
Okay, why are some monks really stern? I think sometimes they're like these chocolates. They're hard on the outside, but they've got a very soft center.
Right. Second question. There, John. Please explain the differences between Pure Land and Nibbana.
Okay.
Why do my Hainanese devotees always pray to get into Pure Land when there's a place called Nibbana, no rebirth? Sadhu.
As I understand Pure Land Buddhism, that Pure Land is like a halfway house between this world and Nibbana. So going to Pure Land is not going to Nibbana, it's on the way. So if you want to take the shortcut, in other words, go straight to Nibbana, this is the way. This is the shortcut to Nibbana. Okay, please come to the microphone, you've got a question.
Chandran.
Yeah.
In this book of Jhana, there's one.
그리고 가시 마이크로폰.
There's one line is stated that piti sukha doesn't arise. It must be because there is not enough contentment. That is, then you highlighted, one is still trying too much. What do you mean? Can you explain, please?
Okay, trying too much. Remember, these are states of stillness. The more, those jhanas are so still, you can't move. It's impossible to move in the jhanas. That's why you just can't come out. You're frozen. Frozen solid, there's no movement possible, like a mountain. Even a mountain can tremble with an earthquake, but in meditation you can't. So, you can understand that stillness can't be achieved by doing something. Now, when you understand that, it's all about letting go, stopping doing things. Too much doing, too much striving moves you too much. So, every stage of this meditation is actually letting go of that which makes you move. Finding the cause of the vibrations which stop you being still. And you discover an amazing insight. The more still you are, the more happy you are. In one of the Jatakas, the Buddha said, the more you abandon the five senses, the more you experience bliss. If you really want to experience total bliss, then abandon the five senses totally. Saying of the Buddha, the more you let go of the five senses, the more you experience happiness. When you let go of the five senses completely, you experience complete happiness. Powerful statement. So you've got to let go. If you do things, those senses will never turn off. You know when you move the mouse on your computer, everything turns on. You've got to keep your mouse absolutely still, and then it turns off. That makes sense? I've only played around with the computer about an hour or so, or maybe a little bit longer, but I don't know too much about that. Is that accurate? Yeah, okay.
Is it related, in these sentences, is it related to your summary edit? First jhana or summary, instead of in sequence, vitaka, vichara, then piti, sukha, ikatata. How can you do it in the other way around? One, two, then three. Instead of ikatata, actually it's the final one.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter, you've got five factors, they're all together, they're all aspects of one and the same thing, like my cup. My cup has got size, it's got colour, it's got shape, it's got weight. That's all aspect of the same cup. I can't take the size and sort of divide it from the colour and the shape and the weight. It's all aspects of the same thing. Like, you know, you're a woman, you're a Malaysian, you're dark-haired, you've got two legs. You can't take, you know, those aspects and just take woman. And what is a woman apart from a body? So these are aspects of the same thing. So the five factors of jhana are one. Seeing the one thing looked at from five different angles. So you actually know exactly that you've been there. Like for example, like the Eiffel Tower, have you ever been to Paris? You know it's tall, it's made of iron, wide at the bottom, thin at the top, or whatever else you describe it as. And when you give those descriptions, three, four, five different descriptions, you say, oh yeah, that's the Eiffel Tower. So you have five different angles of the first jhana. You say, ah, that's what jhana is, the first jhana. Is that your question?
Actually, my question is that how come the ikagata you just put in the center instead of the final factors of jhana?
Because I like putting it in the center because the one-pointedness is a central feature of that jhana. Who cares whether it's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as long as they're all there. Reorder them.
There's no meaning, no purpose.
No meaning, it's just the way I described them, for convenience.
for convenience, because I thought that because due to the ikarakata, that's why it produced the piti sukha.
No, not because of ekagata it produces a piti sukha, because you've let go of the body and the five senses. That's why. And I'll tell you what that means tomorrow, because that's a powerful understanding, a powerful insight. That the five senses and the body are suffering. You know that because when they're gone, you're blissed out. You know that bliss is because a whole heap of suffering has disappeared. Some people think only attachment to the body is suffering. Only attachment to senses is suffering. That experience is so plain. No, the body is. Even in its most happiest of places and situations, is suffering. I'll explain that tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yes, come on, question. Okay, he was not unconscious, he was in a coma. In a coma means you're not able to speak, you're not able to communicate outwards. But very often, and there was a perfect example, he was able to hear, see, feel everything which was going on. And more, also he had his will intact. He could do things inside with his mind, but he couldn't control his body. That link to his body had been cut off. Yeah, of course he was fed. He was fed, I think, just liquid foods. Yeah. Okay. Where is the mind, the consciousness, when the person is in jhanas? Now, it's not the right question, because you've heard me say this wonderful example, which I got from a friend, an old college friend, whose child was in the first grade of school, and the teacher said, as an example to the class, what is the biggest thing in the world? One little child, a 5-6-year-old, said, my daddy is the biggest thing in the world. Those of you who had children can understand that. Another child said, no, an elephant is the biggest thing in the world, because it turned out they had recently been to the zoo. Another child said, no, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. And the daughter of my old friend from college said, you're all wrong. The biggest thing in the world is my eye. This is a brilliant story. And the class stopped, even the teacher didn't understand what she was talking about. Why do you say that? Said the teacher. And this little 5-year-old philosopher said, well, my eye can see her daddy, my eye can see an elephant and a mountain and much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. Now, isn't that brilliant? But you can take that further. The mind can see everything your eye can see, and it can see imaginary things which you will never see in this real world. Your mind can hear sounds, real ones and imaginary. It can smell tastes. It can, smells. It can taste flavors. And it can know physical touches. You can feel physical touches, both imaginary and from your fantasies. But it can also know things. Everything which can be known can fit into your mind. So surely your mind must be the biggest thing in the world. It's not that your mind is in your body somewhere. It's not that your mind is in this room. It's not that this mind is in this earth. This earth is in your mind. The whole universe, past and future, all universes, all things are in your mind. If all that can fit into your mind, Surely the mind is the biggest thing. The mind is the chief, the forerunner of all things, said the Buddha in the first verse of the famous Dhammapada. Now you know what he meant. So it's not that the mind goes anywhere. It's things disappear from the mind. The mind doesn't come out, just things reappear in the mind. No, you don't see. Okay, try that. Yes.
Okay, my name is Derek. Good evening to John Brown.
Good evening.
Yes. I have actually 5 questions. Yeah, it keep on accumulating until I come to the place here. Okay. The first question is, now I actually practiced Vajrayana before I joined Theravada by someone introducing me to Theravada. And I took refuge under Vajrayana. So do I need to take refuge under Theravada school in order to practice?
Okay, you're talking about refuge. Whether you take, whether you're part of Vajrayana or Theravada or Mahayana, Pure Land, you take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So that's all schools. So this is common to us all. And this is one of the wonderful things, that when you go to the heart of each of the great Buddhist traditions, you find we have so much in common. You don't need to actually to take refuge. You don't even need to change from being a Vajrayana to being a Theravada. There's no such thing as a Theravada, there's no such thing as a Vajrayana, it's a Buddhist. So just be a Buddhist, and that means you're free. If you see a really good teacher coming from the Vajrayana tradition, listen to them. If you see a good teacher coming from Zen, listen to them. A good Theravada teacher, listen to them. I don't know what food you like. Do you always eat Chinese food, or you sometimes eat Italian food? Western food?
Various.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. Whatever food tastes nice, go for it.
The second question is regarding, I think, meditation and achieving contentment. How to achieve more lasting contentment? I mean, we are working as a lay person, so sometimes we have time to practice meditations, and sometimes we don't. And sometimes we have stress and confusion. But the contentment during the meditation is, how do we expand the contentment?
How do we expand the contentment? First of all, you have to know what contentment is. So we come to meditation retreats like this to know what we're talking about with contentment, to know what we're talking about by stillness, by peace. And you come to meditation retreats like this and you learn from experience, sometimes by making many, many, many mistakes, as each one of you have. And sometimes you make so many mistakes and so many meditations don't go well. But then when it goes right, you've learned a wonderful lesson. And it's worth it. Just one good meditation for the whole 9 days of the retreat is worth it, basically. Because you're learning what letting go is. You're learning what contentment is. How to be content. And by practicing in this retreat, you go back there in the world. Once you've been on these musical retreats, where people who are gifted in playing the piano or the violin all get together with other people who are so gifted, and they really enhance their skills. They learn from each other so they can go back into the world and they can play the piano at home and delight so many people. So you're learning about your mind. You're fine-tuning your mind here. And so when you go back outside, you'll be able to be so much at peace with the world, and you'll be able to give that peace to others. That's how we develop contentment.
My third question is regarding, Chinese do believe that if you have focus at one thing, you will be able to achieve that achievement. Yeah. And English saying is a tunnel,
light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, at the end of the tunnel. So is that if you are, what you achieve, and the path is actually smoother, then you go to a deviate path.
how do I put it?
Yeah. I know that if you learn about one-pointedness, you know, to actually do one thing at a time, you become very successful. I have to practice that myself. As many of you, you know, have known me for a few years. You know, when I'm giving a talk, I give that talk everything I've got. I'm completely one-pointed in giving the talk. I am not thinking about the meditation which I did beforehand or the letter which I have to write afterwards. I really put everything on the task at hand. Now, when you actually have one-pointedness in what you're doing, it's amazing how much you can achieve. If ever you come and visit my monastery in Australia, most of those buildings I built myself. You're doing. It's amazing how much you can achieve. If ever you come and visit my monastery in Australia, most of those buildings I built myself. I learned how to lay bricks. It was one brick at a time. And here I was, a meditator, wasting my time laying bricks. It wasn't a waste of time at all. I thought at first that, can't I lay people actually do this job for us so I can do some more meditation or teaching? But it wasn't a waste of time, because when I was laying bricks, I gave it everything I've got. I was one-pointed, I was mindful of the task at hand. And I found once I finished doing the physical labor, I went down to sit meditation. I was straight into the meditation very deeply. So first of all, it really surprised me. I thought I was wasting my time just laboring. It was the way I was laying those bricks, by being one-pointed, focusing on the task, which is called samadhi, and being very mindful. In laying bricks, I was building up my mindfulness. I was building up my one-pointedness. In a moment, one task at a time. And that carried on to when I sat on my meditation cushion. Seamlessly. If you know how to meditate, you can lay bricks very perfectly. If you know how to meditate, you can write that letter so clearly. If you know how to meditate, you can get that deal done. You can win that contract very easily. Try it. Yeah?
Okay, my fourth question is regarding jhana. I think I heard the sutta regarding jhana. Another word is trance. But in Chinese, when we say trance, we will believe in xiong tong, when they move a lot. So, is it the same thing, or is it, and if it's not, what is the difference?
Okay, the main difference, in a trance you have no mindfulness. Usually another being takes over your body in a trance. You invite someone else in. In these jhanas, your mindfulness is intense, incredibly powerful, so no other being can come close to you in a jhana. I mentioned this morning about monks in jhana, they cannot be burned, they cannot be harmed or hurt at all. You've got incredible protection and power. My goodness, people can't come close to you in those states. So there's a huge amount of difference. In the jhanas, you are very safe, very protected. You come out with incredible power and bliss. In a trance, you come out just as you did before, maybe even a bit dull and disorientated, because the mindfulness was not there. That's the main difference.
Mindfulness, does it mean that, this is my fifth question, the last one. Mindfulness, does it mean that there is a one-pointed oneness in your meditations? Or
there's many different levels of mindfulness. Ordinary mindfulness moves around so fast from one thing to another. It never spends long enough on anything to really understand it fully. It's one of the reasons why we have delusions, why we misunderstand things. We never really stop to fully see. It's one of the reasons why we do need that stillness to see deeply. And I will tell you about that tomorrow with wisdom. It's only in the deep meditations that mindfulness becomes strong and still. When we talk about this one-pointed business, I like to emphasize it's not one-pointed in space as much as one-pointed in time. Because we think about one-pointedness as focused in space, we don't understand it's focused in time as well. In this incredible, powerful present moment, absolutely still in time. That's what means one-pointedness. But it's also its one-pointedness in its factors. There are five factors, but they are one. I know in Vajrayana, and in Mahayana, we talk a lot about non-duality. Not two. This is the only time in your experience you experience the meaning of non-duality. Because this is the first time there is a oneness of experience. Something which doesn't change for many hours. Where that you are so close to what you're experiencing, you've fully merged. The knower and the known are literally just so close together, it is a oneness. You come out afterwards and you say, non-dual, now I know what that means. That's why it's called ekagata. Not just one-pointedness of mind, another meaning is a oneness and non-duality of your experience.
Thank you so much.
Okay, anytime.
Yes.
So can devas attain jhanas? Why can't devas attain jhanas? If a deva did attain a jhana, there's many levels of devas. If it's a lower realm devas and they attain a jhana, they would immediately leave that realm and attain the higher realms. Just the attainment of jhana by themselves would be an advancement up the rung of heavenhood, if you like. There are some devas who do attain jhanas, such as Mahabrahma. In the suttas, there was this wonderful little story about this monk who gained the psychic powers to visit the deva realms and had this question, where do the four elements cease without remainder? And he couldn't find anyone to answer that question, so he went up to the first level of devas, which is the realm of the four great kings. And they said, listen, we don't know the answer to that question, but there's another group of devas more superior than us, who are called the heaven of the 33. Go on up and ask them. So he went to ask them. He asked Saka, who was the king of these devas of the 33, and he said, I don't know the answer to that question, but there's the Yama devas, who are above us. Maybe they will know. So he went to see the Yama devas. They said, we don't know, but there are the devas of those who, who delight in creations, the Nimanarati devas. Ask them. They said, we don't know, but there's the devas above us, Parinimita Wasawati devas. They might know. And so they went up to them and said, we don't know, but there's Mahabrahma. He will know that the devas of the in companionship with Brahma, they might know. So he went up into this Brahma realm, this lower Brahma realm, those who live in companionship with Brahma. And they said, we don't know, but Mahabrahma, God will know. And he said, where is he? He said, we don't know where he is, but every now and again as a great light appears, and out of that light comes Mahabrahma. You know what that light is again? Nimitta. Because this Mahabrahma goes in and out of first jhana. When he comes out, he's visible to his retinue. And so after a while, Mahabrahma appeared out of the Nimitta. You go in through the Nimitta, you come out through the Nimitta into the jhanas. And this monk asked him, where do the four elements cease without remainder? And Brahma said, I am Brahma, the firstborn, the creator, the lord of all is. And the monk said, I never asked you that. I asked you, where do the four elements cease without remainder? And Mahabrahma says, I am God, the firstborn, the creator of all that is, the lord of everything. I didn't ask you that. Where do the four elements cease without remainder? Read it in the sutta. It's very funny. And Mahabrahma takes the monk by the arm and leads him aside and says, shh, I don't know the answer to that. But these people, they think I'm smart, so no, I don't want them to know. And anyway, monk, you're a very foolish monk. Down where you came from, there's a great Buddha. Ask him. That's very, very cheeky, but it's a very fascinating little sutta there. So, the day was Mahabrahma actually does go in and out of jhana, but only the first jhana. He doesn't know more than that. But if the deva does go into the jhanas, if there's a deva of the realm of the 33, if they can press the letting go button and they go into those jhanas, they would completely disappear from that realm and they get a reappearance and they stay in those jhana realms for a long time. Basically, they pass away from one realm and they reappear in the higher realm. I hope that makes sense. That's what happens. Yeah? Okay, it's a good question, and this is a great point of controversy. Those two early teachers were Allara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. What it says in the text is they had some sort of attainment. First of all, Allara Kalama had the attainment of nothingness, and Udaka Ramaputta, or rather, he was a disciple of Udaka Rama. Udaka Ramaputta means a disciple of Rama the Udakan. He said his teacher used to have the state of neither perception or non-perception. Now, the anomaly is, the question which many people ask, is that if those teachers had practiced jhana, and if the bodhisattva had practiced those jhanas, why had the Buddha to recollect the jhana under the rose apple tree and not the jhana under those two teachers? Also, why was it the Buddha said that actually the day was set, and it was repeated by Ananda, the Buddha discovered the jhanas, not Allara Kalama, Udaka Ramaputta? The only feasible explanation is this, that Udaka Ramaputta, Allara Kalama did not practice the jhanas, nor the arupa states. But what they had there was almost like an echo of those original states. In the same way that even today, because we talk about jhanas and because they're such an important part of the path, 2,500 years since the time of the Buddha, some people teach jhanas, but they're not the real thing. They're not true jhanas, they're something much, much, much less. Simple wishful thinking means we want those jhanas so much, we make do with something which the Buddha would never say qualifies. It's very similar to university degrees. The degree which I got was much harder to get than university degrees these days. The standard has gone down. Even the degree which I got, the standard had gone down over the last 50, 60 years. A good example of that is PhDs, doctorates. In the universities of Europe, 200, 300 years ago, they would issue one doctorate maybe every 6 or 7, 10 years maybe, in the whole university. To get a doctorate, to be a PhD, maybe 200 years ago, you really had to be special. Now, you can order one by post from American universities. I think even I did read an article, I don't know if it's true, in Italy, that even if you got a BA, you can call yourself a doctor. The standard always goes down because of demand, desires. And the thesis which I have, which many monks agree with now, is what Allara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta taught were just a watered down version of those states. They weren't based on the jhanas. Number two, to attain those jhanas, you have to walk the middle path. That middle path was so unrecognizable that the first five ascetics thought the Buddha had actually given up all possibility of attaining anything. The middle path, as the Buddha walked it, was not at all popular. Otherwise, those five ascetics would have recognized it and would have stayed with the Buddha. He was being radical, he was finding a new path. Not something which Udaka Ramaputta and Allara Kalama had practiced. And I'm pretty convinced that Udaka Ramaputta and Allara Kalama, they hadn't any jhanas at all, nor did those incredibly refined immaterial attainments. They weren't the real thing. No more than a doctorate by post is a real doctorate. It's just the same in name, but not in actual essence. Otherwise, there's too many contradictions in the text. And that's a valid proposition. It's a great question. We talk about that a lot. Any other questions? Okay, it's almost five. No, last question. 5 to 10. No, we've got two questions. The last two questions then. Come on. Yeah.
Hello, good evening. I'm Mr. Goh. I have two questions. So plus maybe one question.
Well, we can allow three because everything's done by trees in Buddhism.
First question is, how do you explain the when the snake is in hibernation during winter. In other words, is it another form of meditation? Second is the issue of reincarnation. Thank you.
Okay, the first one is like hibernation, was it? Hibernation, is that some type of meditation? Because I'm not having had a recent rebirth to say hibernating. I'm not quite sure. I can't answer that question. I don't really think so, because those animals, if they came out from hibernation, they'd be just so blissed out of their little furs that they'd sort of, you know, be jumping up and down instead of like being sleepy when they come out. I know that the snakes which come out from hibernation in Australia, they are not sort of, you know, they don't look like happy. They're very hungry and they're very aggressive. The chances are no. With reincarnation, this is one of the advantages, the results of getting into deep meditation. I will mention this tomorrow in the insights talk about seeing things as they truly are. Reincarnation may be a theory, you can take it or leave it, believe it or not, because you haven't got all the evidence. The Buddha said there is a way of finding out for yourselves in this very life. Pachatang Vedittabo, we knew he to be seen each wise person for themselves. If you get even into the nimitta, you see what the jitta is, what the mind is. You know it is not dependent upon the body. The body and the five senses have disappeared when that mind appears. You can understand just from that much, if you've got enough insight, enough intelligence, that that mind will not die, will not disappear when the body dies. Because the body dying is just the same. The body and the five senses are disappearing, they're turning off. And any of you who have had near-death experience or known other people who had near-death experience or read the books about near-death experience, when you die, you float out of your body and you go towards the light. That's a nimitta. Exactly the same. So in this meditation, you're having a rehearsal for death. So you're actually finding out what happens and why it happens. You're doing a laboratory experiment about death. And so it's very common that people who have nimittas, and if they reflect upon it afterwards and gain insight, will understand as a fact that rebirth happens and they will know why. That's the insight which comes up. Alternatively, if you have those nimittas, or you go further and get into a jhana, when you come out, your mind is so powerful, you can ask yourself the question, what is my earliest memory? And you can recollect your past lives. It's not that difficult to do. So you can actually know for a fact who you were in the past, what you were doing, what your name was. Just like in the time of the Buddha, just like the 25 centuries since, monks, nuns, lay men, lay women have been doing this meditation and they recollect their past lives. So the reincarnation is no longer a theory, it is a verifiable fact. It's a scientific fact. I was a scientist. The definition of a scientific fact is it can be verifiable. Someone else can repeat the experiment and find the same result. Meditation is the experiment which you do. If you follow the instructions, you will get the same result. That's why it qualifies as a scientific truth. Okay, there's one last question.
Rowan. Nowadays, many popular Vipassana school will be teaching that we observe the abdomen rising and falling to get into the jhanas and insights. Is this true?
Okay, you can observe the abdomen rising and falling to get into jhanas, again, insight. You can start anywhere to get into jhanas. It's amazing what people can do. They can start in all sorts of places. They can do mantras. They can do the mantra on Amitabha and get into a jhana. Whatever you start from, as long as you let go of the time, let go of the past and the future, eventually let go of thinking, You let go of the five senses and the body, then the jhanas start to occur. Where you start from is irrelevant. It's what you do on the way. You abandon the five hindrances, focus on the mind, the jhanas happen. It's all stages of letting go. You start letting go of one thing, letting go of another thing, letting go of another thing. Once you've let go enough, there you are, that's the jhanas. These are not attainments. If it's attainments, it's what you get. The jhanas are measured not by what you get, but by what you've given up. That's why they are stages of letting go. We meditate not to get things, we meditate to give up things. Please understand that, and you understand the path into the jhanas and what they are. If you're trying to get things, you're going the opposite direction. If you're trying to abandon things, you're going in the right direction. And the jhanas happen. So this is the path of letting go, and now it comes the time to let you go. I'm going to detach from you, I'm going to renounce you, and just like my five senses disappear, you are now all going to disappear. Goodbye. Sada. Now we do this sharing of merits. It's been a very deep and powerful talk. It's great merit this evening for listening to this talk. So let's share the merits. Idam me nyati nang ho tu sukhita hon tu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang ho tu sukhita hon tu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang ho tu sukhita hon tu yatayo. Sadhu. Very good. Okay, good night everybody. Now's the time for you to vanish.